From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A Vietnamese girl runs naked down a dirt road, fleeing an American napalm attack on her village. A Republican soldier in the Spanish Civil War falls backward as a bullet strikes. A Marine medic cradles a frightened Iraqi girl in his arms. The chaos of last month's war around them. Memory freeze frames. Its basic unit is the single image. So writes essayist and novelist Susan Sontag in her new book, Regarding the Pain of Others. More than 25 years after the publication of her groundbreaking work on photography, Sontag challenges her own old assumptions about the impact of human atrocity and war on film. It's photography as history, not sentimentalized truth, that matters, she says now. It's moving beyond emotion to thought when absorbing images of pain and war. Susan Sontag is one of the country's most revered public intellectuals. For some months after 9/11, she was among the most reviled for her tough comments on the immediate reaction of American leaders. Now she's putting pain and images of pain in a new context. So the question for you listeners, can photographs lead us beyond pity to understanding? Do you hold lasting images from the Iraq War, of the Marine doctor holding that young Iraqi girl, of the Iraqi boy in hospital who lost his family and both his arms? How do you confront, absorb, resist these images of pain? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Susan Sontag, writer, intellectual, and author of the new book, Regarding the Pain of Others. Good evening and welcome, Susan Sontag.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks so much for joining us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Susan Sontag.
Hi, Jack.
Susan Sontag, I wish you'd take us in right from the top with the turn that you're making in this book. Your views expressed several decades ago now, astonishingly, in On Photography have become, to some extent, I think you say yourself in the new book, kind of platitudes, just presumed on the effect of the modern parade of images that we're all confronted by, assaulted by, exposed to images of war and pain and suffering. What's the turn you're making in this book from your core insights or observations in On Photography almost, 25 and more years ago now?
Well, let's not make it any more than that. It was 25, I think. I think it was published in 1977 or 1978. Well, listen, you know, apart from what I think of as a rather American pleasure in contradicting myself.
Go for it.
I mean, I think that's maybe, that sounds awfully American. The way one grows or keeps on moving is
we're all entitled.
No, more than entitled. I think it's good. I think it's good because I think one can never grasp more than a corner of the truth. Mm-hmm. And so the real contradiction, I think, the creative form of contradicting yourself is not, you know, making a U-turn and saying I was totally wrong and now I see the truth.
No, and I have to say it doesn't feel like that.
Yeah, but I don't think that's the creative kind of contradiction. Mm-hmm. I think the creative contradiction is saying yes, but, or yes, and. In other words, you see more of the picture. You see more of the story. You know, the big difference between those essays on photography, which I published through the 70s, mid-70s came out in the book in the late 70s, and this book is that I don't really think this is a book about photography. I mean, in the last year and a half when I've been working on it, and friends said, what are you working on? I would say with a sort of gulp, I'm working on a little book about war. Now, war is an awfully big subject, like photography.
Yes.
And so there has to be an angle. It has to be something that you know that you feel competent to talk about. And something I think I do know and do understand is the difference and some of the complicated relationships between the reality of war and the way war is represented. So it starts with the fact that I have actually been in three wars. I was in Vietnam and North Vietnam twice. Yeah. During the Vietnam War. I was in Israel in October of 1973, and I was at the front. I was in Syria. I was on the Golan Heights. I was by the Suez Canal under fire with troops in Israel and in that war, the so-called October War. And most important of all, I spent the better part of 3 years in Sarajevo during the siege, living and working in the city. And so I have had an experience which is pretty rare among people who write about these issues. If there is anybody else who writes exactly about this, I don't think there is actually, but whatever, I know the difference between the image and the reality. And it was that I started with. I started with, well, how much do we know from pictures? And are they deceiving us? In what way are they manipulating us? In what way are they truthful and important to our understanding? And this book really came out of my 3 years in Sarajevo.
We can read that. We can hear it. There's a point in the book, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but you say that, you know, the notion that we just get run over by these images and they turn to nothing and we kind of begin even to look down on them is the height of provincialism. You say there's still real wars going on behind the images that we're presented with.
Well, I think that goes without saying, but it's amazing how many people believe or profess to believe that these images just make us more blasé and insensitive. I'm not at all sure of that anymore. And as I say, it comes out of, and I would never have written this book, because all my stuff, even if I don't talk about myself, which I'm a little shy about doing, comes out of very direct personal experience. In the 3 years of the Siege of Sarajevo, a city that was cut off in every way from the rest of the world, there was no electricity, there was no running water, there was no food, there was no mail, there was no television, there was nothing. You were either in the war or you could leave, as I could because I had UN credentials and I'd go out on a UN troop plane. And then outside, I would see how the war was represented. It wasn't like this war that's just taken place, the American invasion and conquest of Iraq, where the journalists in the Hotel Palestine could look out their window and see what they also were seeing on their television sets right next to the window, which was the footage from Al Jazeera or CNN or what have you. It was a total disconnect between the reality and the image. And that's when I began thinking, when I'd go out of Sarajevo and people would say, well, what was it like? Or they would have really very strange ideas of what it was like. And I'd say, but don't you see it every night on television? Yes, but is it really like that? You know, I think there's also a certain element of disbelief on all sorts of complicated relationships to these images of horror and atrocity. And, I mean, obviously not only war. There are all sorts of painful images which people in privileged parts of the world look at as something really terrible happening, but over there, not here, over there.
Susan Sontag, we'll take your word for it that it's about war and not just images, but it's certainly grounded in conversation about images and at the same time wholly about war and conflict. I wish you'd be good enough to read just a bit for us. If you've got the book and could turn to page 102, there's a bit beginning, People Don't Become. I wondered if you could read right from there to the end of that chapter, that bit.
Sure. I love to read.
This is Susan Sontag reading from her new book, Regarding the Pain of Others.
People don't become inured to what they're shown, if that's the right way to describe what happens, because of the quantity of images dumped on them. It is passivity that dulls feeling. The states described as apathy, moral or emotional anesthesia, are full of feelings, the feelings of rage and frustration. But if we consider what emotions would be desirable, it seems too simple to elect sympathy. The imaginary proximity to the suffering inflicted on others that is granted by images suggests a link between the faraway sufferers seen close up on the television screen and the privileged viewer, that is simply untrue. That is yet one more mystification of our real relations to power. So far as we feel sympathy, we feel we are not accomplices to what caused the suffering. Our sympathy proclaims our innocence as well as our impotence. To that extent, it can be, for all our good intentions, an impertinent, if not an inappropriate, response. To set aside the sympathy we extend to others beset by war and murderous politics for a reflection on how our privileges are located on the same map as their suffering and may, in ways we might prefer not to imagine, be linked to their suffering, as the wealth of some may imply the destitution of others. This is a task for which the painful, stirring images supply only an initial spark.
Jack Beattie, I want to bring you in here. Susan Sontag doesn't read from her work without getting a lot of thinking going, and that passage got a lot going in me.
Well, I think, but if I can interrupt,
yes,
Tom,
please.
This is one of the key passages in the book.
Yeah.
If I would have to say where is the heart of the argument as opposed to what I like to think of are a lot of very interesting anecdotes and
A lot of interest in
and that would be one of the key passages.
Well, it's what drew my eye out of 120, 130 pages full of interesting anecdote and moments in history, some way back in history. But, Jack, I'm wondering what all this is stirring in you. We've all just come through a quick war, lots and lots of images, TV images, still images, where Susan Sontag still sees the kind of seat of memory residing in still photographs, not television. But here we are very much in the media age, and Susan Sontag is saying we're not inured just by a flood of images. It's passivity. It's a failure to respond, to think about what we're seeing.
Yes, I think this passage and the book as a whole comes back again and again to the idea that pity is not enough. It's cheap. It's easy. And one of the things that enters into the distance between us and the suffering of the person depicted is our almost sort of condescension, our pity, our feeling that this is bad. And with our pity often goes a kind of self-approval. I know I feel that. I'm a good person because I look at that photograph and I feel pity and I feel horror. And I am a good person because I feel that. So that this tragedy becomes an occasion for sort of virtue. And I think the point she makes here is, you can't stop there. And if you do, you're just sort of, you cut off any ethical connection to this at all. You've made it simply something about your sensibility and your inner validation. You've got to say why and who and what brought this about and, you know, who pulled the trigger and why was it in that person's hand and what do I, as a taxpayer of a country that just went to war, have to do with this? And why didn't I do more to stop it if I thought that this is the kind of image with which it would be rife? You've got to ask all those questions. In short, you've got to think.
Susan Sontag, is that it?
Jack, if I can just add to that, I absolutely agree with what you say, but I think whether or not one actually goes to the lengths of saying I'm a virtuous person because I feel pity, my moral ducks are in the right row, I think you certainly feel innocent. Mm. By the very act of pitying, you are saying, well, it's not me. I didn't do this. And I think somehow it's, how can I say, exculpatory. I mean, even though we know we are citizens and taxpayers, somehow you are separating yourself off from the evil done. And don't you think it's a kind of proclamation of innocence? I don't know if you agree with that or not.
No, I see exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
This is, in other words, it isn't anything you're responsible for. It's something you can luxuriate in.
Well,
feel,
I deplore.
Yeah.
And say, oh, my God. And, you know, it might take the banal form of a God, war is hell. But you see, then there's a next step, which is, isn't that awful? I feel so sorry for them. But hey, it could have been worse. There could have been more people killed. After all, it came through pretty fast. There's one other thing I want to say about these images, because of the way Tom just described them. He says we have just come through a war where we've seen a lot of images. But I think Americans should be reminded that the images they're seeing are not the images, not at all identical with the images that people in Canada were seeing, mm-hmm. in Great Britain, in Spain, in Italy, in Germany, and France. And I'm mentioning countries, some of which associated themselves with the American effort and some of which opposed it, like France and Germany and Canada. But in all of those countries, I've seen these images, and I have friends who are reporting to me from these different countries what they were watching on television.
A very different view.
Much more stuff about civilian casualties.
And blood and gore. Susan Sontag, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with writer and thinker Susan Sontag about images of war and suffering. Do photographic images help us feel the pain of others or inure us to that pain? After your emotional response to a war photo, do you feel a responsibility to think about who is responsible? This is on. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with writer and thinker Susan Sontag about images of war and suffering and what we do with them. You can join the conversation. Can, do photographs lead us beyond pity to understanding, to action? And what photos from the Iraq War have stuck with you? Do you remember that shot of the Marine doctor holding the little Iraqi girl? Do you remember his face, her face, how you felt when you read her parents had been killed by U.S. soldiers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Susan Sontag, you've got some marvelous history in here about the long relationship between the way people thought about photographs of pain and suffering in war and their expectations about war itself. You begin with Virginia Woolf, and I wish you'd take us back to that and the kind of premise that she brought to her observation of the photographs coming out of the Spanish Civil War.
Well, you know, again, taking on the subject of war is so enormous, and the thinking about war, you know, this very angle where I go into the subject, the door I open, I'm just trying to think, well, is there a history? To me, there's a history of everything. I feel I don't understand anything unless I know its genealogy, something of its genealogy or its history. So I was thinking, well, I know the way we think about photographs now and the complexity and the ambivalence we feel to these images. They feel assaultive. They feel necessary. They feel, as if they're so commercialized that how could we possibly continue to respond to them?
Mm-hmm.
War in your living room, that kind of. We have all these complicated feelings, which I think have been going on pretty much since the Vietnam War, although obviously the most memorable images there, and I want to come back to this point, I think tend to be still images rather than television footage.
Despite television's big entrance into our lives out of the Vietnam War.
It is, yes. That was the first war that was continuously televised or in which we had a lot of footage. I mean, not in the way we do now, but still a great deal of footage every day. But I think if people think about the Vietnam War in terms of photographs, they remember the famous still photographs, like the little girl that you mentioned in that famous photograph, who's not fleeing her village who has been napalmed. She is, has been
She's
herself
been napalmed, yes.
Napalmed with other children.
Mm-hmm.
The larger
Crying
version
behind.
Of that picture, it's actually a cropped photograph that we mainly see. There are other children running down that road, and
That's
they've
right.
also been napalmed.
Mm-hmm.
But those are still photographs. Anyway, I was trying to think, at what point did the photographic representation of war attain enough volume that it became a kind of accompaniment of war in people's imagination, whether the war, you know, when the war was taking place somewhere else?
Mm-hmm.
And I, the more I thought about it, and it was a hunch, but I still think I'm right, I think the turning point was the Spanish Civil War in the late 1930s. This for a number of reasons. First of all, a technological one, that it was only very recently before that that cameras had become so light and portable that they could be taken into battle and you could actually get this sort of close-up work. And then I stumbled by accident on a passage at the beginning of a book by one of my favorite writers, Virginia Woolf, which is a very odd book and not at all a book that was successful, called Three Guineas that she wrote late in her life on the eve of the Second World War, which is a
book about war.
And she starts with this very curious passage, which I hadn't remembered, though I had read the book before, but I was just, I don't know, browsing and I like to reread certain people, and Virginia Woolf was one of them. And suddenly this thing leaped off the page at the very beginning when she says, it's an imaginary letter. I think it's a letter to an imaginary interlocutor, a man. And she says, could we have the same reaction to war, given that you're a man and I'm a woman and war is pretty much a man's business? Even if you're against war, maybe men are against war in a different way that women are against war. Let's look at some of the pictures that the Spanish government has been sending out. And then she describes, they're not in the book, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't occur to her to put them in the book. See, that's an interesting thing. We're talking about 1938.
Right.
She describes photographs very much like the ones we're talking about, of torn bodies of children in a bombing of a village by the, you know, the Franco forces, the fascist rebellion, which in fact won, and ruled Spain then for another 30 years, 40 years actually.
But the conclusion she comes to is that if we look at these, we will end up opposed to war, that we will congeal around opposition to war,
and
more than that, that war itself might be made unacceptable through this close observation through photographs.
Yeah, you see, let's turn it around. She is saying, if you look at these pictures, you couldn't possibly be for war. These pictures are so shocking. Let's make an effort and look at them. And then what I take from that is several things. One of them is that those pictures were still rare, that this was almost clandestine knowledge, that she was saying, look, you know, every week I get this packet of photographs. Let's imagine we're sitting down together and looking at these pictures.
It's a new experience.
She's not seeing them every single day in every magazine and newspaper she opens. There's no television yet. She's not watching this kind of stuff on the night. In other words, that's the moment when photographs are still rare, relatively rare, of this kind. You know, the First World War photographs, they were almost all taken by camera on tripod.
And she's clearly shocked, but by late in the book, Susan Sontag, you're coming around and talking to a contemporary reader who's living in the media age, and you say something quite different. At that point, you say, someone who is perennially surprised that depravity exists, who continues to feel disillusioned, even incredulous when confronted with evidence of what humans are capable of inflicting in the way of gruesome hands-on cruelties upon other humans, has not reached moral or psychological adulthood. No one, after a certain age, has the right to this kind of innocence or superficiality, to this degree of ignorance or amnesia. That's tough.
Yeah, but I really believe that's true, that we have so much evidence now. If you've ever taken in any great evil, let's take the benchmark of evil that we all acknowledge has never been surpassed, which is the Nazi concentration camps. Mm-hmm. Once you have actually taken it in that people can do that, or take the genocide in Rwanda in 1995, 800,000 people slaughtered hands-on in a period of 6 weeks. Not bombs from the air, but with machetes, one by one. I think this isn't because Rwandan Hutus or Germans are more wicked than anybody else on the planet. This is what people are capable of under certain circumstances. And I think if you take that in or you don't, I don't feel that Virginia Woolf is saying, my God, I'm so shocked there can be war. I think she's saying, I mean, because I think she was incredibly intelligent and would never make such a naive statement. I think she's saying there is a failure of imagination among those of us who are far from the conflict, and these pictures will help us realize the horror and mobilize us to act. But I don't think she's saying, oh my God, people make war. I mean, no one who's read history or literature could possibly be shocked at that. And yet, one is always coming across people who are really surprised. They're surprised by evil. They're surprised by evil at every level. You know, the nice husband and father, you know, who goes to the PTA meetings and then turns out to be some sort of axe murderer with the corpses of 17 girls in the basement. And then one says, how can that be? How can it be that a perfectly nice, respectable person can also have been a monster? How can it be that the commander at Auschwitz would go home, kiss his wife, and sit down and play Schubert after a day of, you know, of murdering people
and sending them to the
crematoria?
Yeah.
But the fact is, that is what human beings are capable of. And, you know, they are capable of having normal lives and being monsters.
And you're saying in this book, regarding the pain of others, not get over it, but fully take that fact on board, live with it, and move on from there. Shock is not enough. Jack Beatty, it's interesting, though, as grounded in photographs as Susan Sontag's book is in many ways, as she looks at war and suffering, she comes around to this interesting point. She says the problem is not that people remember through photographs, which we obviously do, but that they remember only the photographs. This remembering through photographs eclipses other forms of understanding and remembering. She goes on to say, to remember is more and more not to recall a story, but to be able to call up a picture, as though photography, in some sense, Jack, reduces understanding to the two-dimensionality of a photograph.
Yeah, that's very provocative, as was the discussion about what people are capable of. That reminded me of Karl Jaspers' comment that what we saw in the Holocaust was the human essence in the German form, a very humbling thought when you apply it in one resident. But yes, there's a way in which the political contexts and the historical contexts and the things that the tendrils that are not in the photograph but that made it possible, all that is abstracted, is cut out, and narrative, the telling of history, analysis, all of that is, you've got to supply it. And at one point you say, Susan, that in Bosnia, the Serbs and the Bosnians were using the same photograph,
yes,
just putting different captions under it.
There were some photographs of children who had been killed in an air raid, and it was not the Bosnians and the Serbs. It was actually the Serbs and the Croatians. But never mind. I mean, as much as I love the Bosnians, I don't want to say they were utterly incapable of it, though that it wasn't the Bosnians. It was the Bosnians and the Croatians. It was in the first year of the war, 1991, the Serbs and the Croatians before the Bosnians were part of the war. And yes, both sides were using the same images. And of course, there's the perennial story that these atrocities really didn't happen. They brought bodies from the morgue and threw them on the street.
Right, right. But you know, one of the points...
They bombed themselves, et cetera,
sure,
et cetera.
Sure. Another point you make related to this is, what about the image we don't see? And this came to me when I read a story in the New York Times that ended, this was buried in the newspaper, it ended with a New York Times reporter telling of how she was on a bridge and she saw some Marines and they gave civilians...
This is just now in Iraq.
Yeah. She and the Marine said to the people, don't come forward, don't walk in our direction. They had some sort of sign. And there was a man, he was in his 70s, and he was on a cane, and he was uncertain. He was shaky. He was going one way and going the other way. Well, he leaned a little too much toward the Marines, and they shot him dead.
Yeah,
now, that was in a story. I wonder what would have happened if that had been in a photograph. And I had the same thought, really, about your wonderful film, Jerusalem. You show us what isn't shown about war. You end in a psychiatric ward, as I remember.
Yeah, with shell-shocked soldiers.
Which suddenly, this is, we don't see this image. This is what, in a way, that was like that Time story. We don't see that image. We don't see the psychiatric ward. What about that? I mean,
it's very easy to say that showing people horrible pictures isn't going to turn them off war. And yet, I always feel there's a reality gap. I always feel that you have to make people work to experience what they experience, and to not be mystified and misled by the images which let us all off the hook. I mean, there's no way that the pictures of war or footage of war or fictional representations of war are ever going to convey the horror of war. They can't. I mean, for one thing, just the smell isn't there, and the unbelievably loud noise. I mean, that it's 100 times louder than you ever hear when you hear it on TV or in a film. I mean, war is, first of all, noise.
Not to mention, Susan Sontag, the editing that goes on.
And the fear and the peeing in your pants and everything that is humiliating and horrible. This can't be experienced. But I don't draw from this the conclusion that we ought not to have the images. What I say is, and Jack was saying this before, we need words. We need a context. We need a surround. I mean, images don't come naked into the world. They come, you know, with a certain point.
But you're saying increasingly that the words are stripped away and images without elaboration are often what comprise contemporary memories. Susan Sontag, Jack, stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. I want to begin to let them in. Andrea is calling from Boston. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hi. Given, I guess, that you're addressing a point that most of the photos are devoid of context, I'm wondering if viewers of these photographs ever really get genuine information from the photos, or if their interpretations of the images are so heavily influenced by their previous ideology that the images just serve to reinforce what they already believe, meaning like someone who is pro-war looked at the Marine doc and saw him as a hero, whereas someone who is anti-war looked at the girl he was holding and saw her as another victim of the war, but didn't actually get any new information about the context in which the image was functioning?
It's a wonderful question, Andrea.
Right.
Susan.
I think you're right, Andrea. I think you are right. I think for the most part, and that's a perfect example, you show that picture in a certain context, and it's look at our compassionate American, heartbroken at this sadness, and you show it in another context, and you point out that this is a victim, an innocent victim. Her family has been killed. Lots of civilians were killed, and this is a war which was not justified. I mean, that's another context for the same picture. So I always say the picture doesn't come naked into the world. The picture has a surround, and the same pictures can have very different meanings. Now, maybe pictures reach a critical mass, and maybe as opinion starts to change, people read pictures differently. But in and of themselves, no, I don't think they help us to understand. They do help us to feel something, but I don't think on the whole they challenge our understanding or improve our understanding. Mm. That, for that, we need narration. We need words.
Andrea, thanks for your call. Joanne's calling. Hi, Joanne. You're on the air.
Hi. My experience has been completely opposite of what is described by Ms. Sontag. And, mm-hmm. When I was for the war, and after September 11th, I read the National Security Strategy, and it seems like a very hopeful plan. I'm hoping democracy takes a foothold in Iraq. But after the war started and the images started coming back and website after website had slideshow after slideshow, I felt responsible and complicit for the individual suffering that I saw. And it bothers me to today. And I'm hoping that the arguments that I still believe, if it's capable of happening, I'm hoping that all of those arguments put forth in the National Security Strategy actually work, and that when I see images of the people who had gone in the religious ceremonies and were beating themselves with chains, and I see that the differences between our cultures that we can't possibly understand, I think that probably those things are unsurmountable or insurmountable.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid I agree with you. Mm. I thought from the beginning, quite apart from what I think about America becoming, you know, ruler of the planet and the president of the United States becoming the president of the planet, leaving all that aside, I think when you have a country which is more than 60% Shiite, who have been repressed in all this period, we're talking about, you know, very, very radical kind of Islamic fundamentalism, and then they've been repressed all this period by this horrible dictator, and God knows that Saddam Hussein was a horrible dictator, then democracy is not going to mean democracy in our sense at all. And I think that we've walked into a situation, once again, where Americans who are very gung-ho and very practical, and we think we'll solve this problem, but we don't seriously understand the culture difference and the history. And so I was never optimistic. I think it's fascinating that someone like yourself, who sincerely, you know, took very sincerely the arguments about mass weapons of destruction and all that other, I think, untrue arguments for the war, but sincerely did feel that this was a chance to bring a better life to these people who were suffering under a horrible dictatorship.
And has now turned around. Susan Sontag, we have to take a short break. Please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with writer and thinker Susan Sontag about images of war and suffering and what we do with them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Susan Sontag, I couldn't help, as I read your book regarding the pain of others, the new book, and a wonderful book. I enjoyed it enormously, but I could not help but think back to the essay that came out in The New Yorker that you had there the week after 9/11, for which you got run all around the block, chastised and chased for writing whatever may be said of the perpetrators of Tuesday's slaughter. They were not cowards. But you went on in that very short essay to deliver what looked to me like a kind of precursor of this book. You wrote, a lot of thinking needs to be done. Here's thinking again. No, don't just feel what the image suggests, but think. A lot of thinking needs to be done, and perhaps is being done in Washington and elsewhere, about the ineptitude of American intelligence and counterintelligence, about options available to American foreign policy, blah, blah. The public is not being asked to bear much of the burden of reality. You seem to be coming back to that same point in this book. Feel the pictures.
Sure, it's the same point. It's the same writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel absolutely nothing to apologize for in that statement that I made a few days later after 9/11. I mean, I was talking about the media representation mm-hmm. of the event. To me, there was nothing radical, or I thought it was pure common sense what I said. The context of the remark about courage was, I said you can't slam every single, you can't hurl every single insight and injury and insult at the terrorists. I mean, that just it's meaningless. It's absolutely meaningless. I mean, I don't think courage is a moral virtue. That's my only point.
But I'm really turning to the reality gap you described.
I think scoundrels and terrorists mm-hmm. and criminals can be brave. I mean, I don't think being brave is only the property of good people. That's all I was saying.
Are we still living in that reality gap that you described?
Well, I think that the nature of our politics is absolutely such as to take us away from reality. That was the show that, you know, the President Bush put on when he, landed on the aircraft carrier. It was all about triumphalism, about America is virtuous, America is always triumphant. You know, as they always say, if you are not a success, then redefine success. Whatever happens in Iraq, we are a success because we deserve to do whatever we want to do. We have proclaimed the right to act unilaterally and not be bound by any international agreement whatsoever if we don't feel it's in our interest. I mean, these are pretty radical statements, and I don't think they have much to do with reality. They're not helping people to understand reality. If the citizens of the United States think it's fine that the President of the United States be the President of the planet, they may be a little surprised that not everybody agrees that that's a great idea.
And yet you write that, coming back to the issue of images, that what can be shown and what should not be shown as a kind of, you know, talismans of what's going on, as direct representation of what's going on, is always a huge point of public debate during war. It was during this war as well. What's that about, this debate over what ought to be in the morning newspaper?
Well, there's a lot of self-censorship now in this country and a lot of intimidation by authorities that amounts to censorship. And, of course, very often people will say, well, we shouldn't show that because it's unpatriotic or it's demoralizing or it's in bad taste. I always get nervous when people say they shouldn't do something because it's bad taste. I mean, that's a criterion for an individual. I don't think it's a criterion for an institution.
But it usually means too gruesome.
Well, it depends on what you're being gruesome about. I mean, we saw an awful lot of gruesome images of the enemy. What about those photographs which I mentioned and regarding the pain of others where you mm-hmm. see this Taliban soldier, wounded Taliban soldier, being dragged out of a ditch and slaughtered, his face right there, you know, in front of the camera? I don't think if pictures of Americans, or I should even say Europeans, were ever shown, there would be a tremendous outcry. But somehow we don't imagine that people in Kabul actually can go to an internet cafe and look at the New York Times, or that this man had, you know, a wife, sisters, mother, daughter, brothers, whatever, who could actually see what happened to him.
We
worry about the grief, of people we can identify with, namely our own tribe.
Susan Sontag, we are out of time, and I regret to say it. I hope we'll have you back. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Okay, enjoyed it very much. Bye, Jack.
Bye. Thank you for being with us.
Okay, bye.
Susan Sontag's new book is Regarding the Pain of Others. Well, Jack, she was chased and chastised, but there is a thinker, whatever you make of her thinking.
Oh, yes, and I said to you earlier that I remember the first thing I read of hers was in 1966, and this latest publication is just as vivid and thought through and shot through with perception. She's a remarkable writer.
But who has an interest in pushing the American mind through the photograph to that litany of things that must be thought about in Susan Sontag's view?
Oh, right. I mean, and how vulnerable we are to the images as shown and the images as italicized. Is it the wonderful doctor or is it the horror of our of our troops. I guess it depends upon your ideological fix.
I guess. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, to view some of the images discussed in Susan Sontag's book regarding the pain of others, go to our website at onpointradio.org. In a moment, On Point's audio archaeologist digs up a 1950s parody of the McCarthy hearings. This is On Point. Earlier this week, the Senate unsealed thousands of pages of transcripts of secret committee hearings led by Senator Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s, targeting suspected communists. One of the men interrogated by the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations was writer Reuben Shipp. Tonight, On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors brings us the story of this Canadian national who, after being deported because of his tangle with McCarthy's committee, created a radio parody of the hearings that eventually found its way to the Oval Office.
Like many talented Canadian-born writers in the 1930s, Reuben Shipp came to the United States to find work in radio. Shipp's early work, witty and intelligent, came to the attention of a New York producer in 1941, and he soon found work with Samuel Goldwyn as a scriptwriter for the popular radio program The Life of Riley. But in 1951, Shipp ran afoul of Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee in their investigation of communist influence in Hollywood. He was questioned for his affiliation with the Radio Writers Guild and left-wing sentiment he expressed in a lecture, overheard by an FBI agent, on radio in a free culture. Shipp was unrepentant before the committee, whose members he labeled witch hunters, and as a resident alien, he was particularly vulnerable to the power of the committee. In July 1953, Shipp, ill with osteomyelitis, a chronic bone infection, was handcuffed and transported to a Detroit prison hospital, where he spent a hellish night. The following day, he was delivered to the Canadian authorities in Windsor. A year after his deportation, Shipp wrote a biting and politically provocative script for a satirical radio drama called The Investigator, broadcast in Canada on CBC. The televised Army-McCarthy hearings in the spring of 54, which proved to be McCarthy's undoing, provided the perfect backdrop to Shipp's drama.
Urgent request that before sundown, when we know of anyone serving the communist cause, we let the agency know. We're now letting you know that your man did belong to this organization for...
Although never mentioned by name, the central character of the play is Joe McCarthy, who, upon dying in a plane crash, finds himself just outside the pearly gates, appearing before Heaven's Committee on Permanent Entry. The committee, it turns out, is composed of a cast of historical characters only McCarthy could appreciate, including Torquemada of the Spanish Inquisition and Cotton Mather of the Salem Witch Trials. They are well aware of McCarthy's work.
One factor outweighs all other considerations. In you, we have a man who can bring to the committee's work the latest inquisitorial techniques.
Gentlemen, I cannot find the words to express my feelings of humble gratitude at the signal honor you are conferring upon me.
The committee, suspicious of a plot engineered down there by Satan and his minions, arranges for McCarthy to search for subversives in paradise.
In all humility, I dedicate myself to the task of bringing to light the facts of this monstrous conspiracy that threatens our way of life up here. And I shall not cease until I have fixed the blame for 1,000 years of treason.
McCarthy manages to gain control over the Committee on Permanent Entry. He then presides over deportation hearings for a parade of historical undesirables, from Socrates to Chopin. One who finds himself under investigation is Thomas Jefferson.
Please state your full name.
Thomas Jefferson.
Your occupation?
President.
Did you engage in any other occupation, Mr. Jefferson?
I was a gentleman farmer.
No, I'm not referring to that.
During Shipp's testimony before the HUAC in 1951, he had memorized a quote from Jefferson on the toleration of error of opinion. At the end of Shipp's oration, Representative Francis Walter snapped, "Who do you think you're kidding?" Shipp never forgot this exchange and recast it in the radio script by putting the oration in Jefferson's voice and Walter's rejoinder, grammatical error and all, in McCarthy's voice.
If there be any among us who wish to dissolve this union, let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it.
Who are you trying to kid, Tom? I've asked you a simple question. Why don't you cooperate with this committee? Are you opposed to the work of this committee? Don't you think this committee has a right to expose subversives like this Socrates?
Soon after the CBC broadcast of The Investigator, which was well received in Canada, bootleg tapes began turning up across the border. By December, WLIB in New York had broadcast the drama, and a small American label, Disc Curiosities, had been set up for American distribution of an LP version, one that would sell over 100,000 copies. A New York Times column by Jack Gould on the release of the LP noted what was being whispered around Washington, that President Eisenhower had convened a special cabinet meeting for the purpose of listening with apparent delight to a tape of the broadcast. One scene from the drama that must have been especially amusing to Ike was McCarthy's inevitable conclusion that the monstrous, diabolical conspiracy to subvert heaven could be traced all the way up to the chief.
Certain personal investigations I've made have led me to an inescapable conclusion. Oates, you will issue the subpoena immediately.
For whom?
Who do you think? The chief.
Of course, when you're in heaven, the chief can only mean the deity himself. On Earth, McCarthy's attacks on the army as a haven for Reds implicated the former World War II general, President Eisenhower. In fact, when the John Birch Society was formed in 1958, founder Robert Welch privately circulated a bizarre document that accused Ike of being a conscious member of the communist conspiracy. Back in heaven, the Committee on Permanent Entry began an assembly line process of deportations to down there. McCarthy eventually finds himself at odds with his Inquisitor colleagues. He's gone so far as to subpoena God himself. McCarthy cracks under the stress of his unrestrained power, muttering that he's the chief. The committee turns against him, deporting him to down there. But the process is disputed by Satan, who doesn't want him there either.
I now inform you that I refuse entry to the applicant.
You refuse? But you can't refuse.
I can, and I do refuse. I have certain rights too, you know. You must give me my due, as the saying goes.
Neither heaven nor hell wants him. McCarthy is returned unharmed to the mountain where the plane crash had taken his life.
He was the only survivor?
No doubt about it. I think you ought to know, Mr. Garson, the crash seems to have affected his mind.
Well, after all, the shock.
It's a little more complicated than that, I'm afraid. He keeps babbling about being the chief and something about no one being too high and phrases like up here and down there.
Well, at least his life was spared.
Mr. Garson, the plane crashed on top of a mountain thousands of feet high. Yet he was found wandering about at the foot of the mountain.
Well, what of it?
The authorities say it's absolutely impossible for any human being to get down that mountain in the dark by himself.
It was an act of God, Doctor. An act of God.
Ship's depiction of a McCarthy nobody wanted, abandoned and ignored, was precise in its prediction of what was to unfold for the Wisconsin senator. McCarthy's downfall began with a remarkable moment on national television when the Army's special counsel, Joseph Welch, turned to McCarthy and said,
"Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last?"
In December of 1954, the Senate voted 67 to 22 to condemn McCarthy for abuse of power. He descended into political infamy and alcoholism and died at Bethesda Hospital in 1957. Reuben Shipp continued to write, publishing two print editions of The Investigator over the years. He lived until 1975 when he left us down here for his own visit with Heaven's Gatekeeper.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. To listen to Reuben Shipp's entire radio drama, The Investigator, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.